Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. Wow, well, we can all breathe a sigh of at least momentary relief on the reproductive rights front as issue one passed by a healthy margin. Reproductive rights, including the right to an abortion, are now to be inscribed in the state's constitution, effectively prohibiting Republican legislatures from making it illegal under most circumstances. Opponents of women's equality have vowed to keep trying to take away the right to an abortion, but they'll have to go back to trying to whittle away at access rather than the blunt approach of trying to ban it altogether. Ohio rules. Ohio will soon also see legalized recreational marijuana, joining Michigan and a growing number of states around the nation, and possibly eventually leading to federal laws being changed. Next week, the Ohio Department of Natural Resources Commission on Oil and Gas Land Use will again meet to determine the fate of several state parks, as they debate whether to approve several proposed fracking leases. As reported here on this program over a month ago, the fracking operation would not take place within the park's boundaries, but on private lands adjacent to the parks, but the drilling would be at an angle going underneath the parks and injecting a toxic mix of chemicals into the shale beds and very likely threatening water supplies in the affected areas. SaveOurParks.org will have more information if you would like to attend. The news, of course, is divided between the Trump trial and the bombardment of Gaza, between the prosecution of the former president and the persecution of Palestinians without restraint. The death toll in Palestine has now surpassed 10,000, with an estimated one-third of those being children. As Israel bombs homes, offices, roads, and hospitals, allegedly as it searches for Hamas leaders and a network of underground tunnels in which Hamas is currently hiding. Rallies calling for a ceasefire and an end to the Israeli occupation of the remaining fragments of Palestine were held all over the world this past weekend, with an estimated 100,000 or more marching in Washington, D.C., and 50,000 marching in Toronto. London, Australia, New Zealand, Germany, Greece, and France all saw major demonstrations, mostly led by anti-Zionist Jews who were breaking the silence in increasing numbers. Democracy Now! Has been virtually a lone voice among nationally syndicated programs covering the Palestinian perspective, allowing Palestinian spokespeople and critics of Israel to speak at length, uninterrupted by rhetorical debate. And we've attempted to do that here as well, as this is one of the noblest functions of community radio. But in today's show, I thought it would be good to hear an insider's view of Israel and its national culture from an Israeli critic, journalist Gordon Levy. He writes an award-winning column for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, and he tours occasionally outside of Israel. Here he is at a forum some 5 years ago in New York.
I'm very pleased to welcome back Haaretz columnist Gideon Levy. His column in Haaretz, he's called for greater Israeli empathy towards the suffering of Palestinians. He's an extremely well-known commentator because of his willingness to take on tough issues. Consequently, he's no stranger to very intense opposition. His columns about politics, money, how Israel's military occupation is changing Israeli society, and about U.S.-Israel relationships are very widely read, reposted, and discussed around the world. Who doesn't get in their inbox a Levy column once in a while? His vocal opposition to Israel's last major invasion and bombing of Gaza took place against an enormous backdrop of widespread support for the military operation within the Israeli public. And so he gave voice to those who were secretly against the war, but cautious about voicing such opinions openly. He was a recipient with Palestinian pastor Mitra Raheb of the 2016 Olaf Palm Prize for their fight against occupation and violence. He's also received the Peace Through Media Award at the 2012 International Media Awards, the Euromed Journalist Prize for 2008, the Leipzig Freedom Prize in 2001, the Israeli Journalist Union Prize in 1997, and the Association of Human Rights in Israel Award for 1996. I would like to encourage everybody to send in your comment cards. We have a number of students and interns who are circulating and picking those up so that we can have a very wide-ranging set of questions for Gideon when he finishes. His book, The Punishment of Gaza, was published in 2012 by Verso Publishing House in London and New York. And he will be available to sign some copies of that book during the reception. But now, please welcome Gideon Levy.
Thank you. Thank you, Grant. I was wondering about whom were you talking about. Can I stay here and not go back home? It's my third time here with those wonderful people. And a third time, on one hand, I feel so much at home. I know so many faces. You all get younger, I get older. You all get more energized and more devoted, and I get more and more desperate. But it put me also on a challenge, because already in my second time here, I started my speech, as far as I can recall, with the concern that I'm going to repeat myself and woe you to death. Because by the end of the day, I'm a singer of one song, and you've heard it already. But the organizers were sophisticated enough this time, and they gave a very strange title to my speech, which doesn't enable me to sing my song. I have to fit to a new song. So I'll do my best, but I'm really, really so grateful for all the wonderful people who brought me here, and Catherine, my partner. This day was so interesting for us, so enriching. In Hebrew, we have this expression, we came to strengthen and we came out strengthened. And this is what I feel after a conference like this. This maybe you are holding the key for any kind of change, for any kind of hope. Because as I'll try to claim later on, the hope for change within Israeli society is so limited, is non-existent. And when the United States is so still, so crucial, people like you really can make the difference. People like you can really be a game changer, and I mean it. It was never before that Israel and the United States shared the same values like in those days. The only place on earth that Donald Trump is beloved, admired, adored, and appreciated is Israel. The only place that Benjamin Netanyahu is admired, adored, beloved is the United States. If this is not shared values, what is shared values? Some of my ex-best friends are on their way now to the real thing, to the APEC conference, which will start on this weekend. Politicians, journalists, to what I call as the annual drug dealers conference. They will discuss how many more drugs will they send to the Israel occupation addicted state, how much more friendship will they express, and how much more money and weapons will they supply. And I can tell you, in the United States, as an Israeli, we don't have a bigger enemy than the Jewish lobby. We don't have a bigger enemy for justice, for peace, for equality than those who think that if you supply the drug addicted with more drugs, you are his friend. That if you support him blindly and automatically, whatever he does, you are a friend. No, my friends, those are not friends, those are enemies. And I can't tell you how happy and proud I am to be here today and not there tomorrow. Thank you. The title of my lecture speaks about Zionism. And Zionism is one of the two religions of Israel. And as religion, as any religion, you can't question it. The second religion is obviously the religion of security. So between Zionism and security, anyone in Israel who dares to raise any kind of question marks is immediately perceived as a traitor. It's impossible to describe you. What does it mean to say that you have some questions about Zionism? Imagine yourself if you question today the other religion, if you claim that the Israeli IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, are not the most moral army in the world. Let's say they are the second moral army in the world. How dare you? We are getting it with the milk of our mothers, even though my mother was not such a Zionist, I think. But it's very hard to understand from the outside how an ideology became part of the DNA. How an ideology became something which must be taken for granted and there is no room for any question marks. I know it about myself. I know how I grew up. I know what I thought about those very, very, very few who claim that they are not Zionists or, God forbid, anti-Zionists. They were the Satans, even though they were Jews and Israelis. I don't recall one example on earth in which an ideology is so totalitarian, is so saint, is so holy that you have no right to put any kind of doubts, question marks, nothing, not about the past, not about the future, not about the present, nothing. It's unbelievable when you live in a state in which if you declare that you don't accept this ideology, you are not part of the place. You are not part of society. You have no place there. Go to Gaza. Go to Damascus. Don't stay here. And this leads me to the title. Because when it comes to Zionism and friends, we have to face reality. When it comes to Zionism, there is no difference in Israel between left and right. When it comes to the occupation, which is part and parcel of Zionism, there is no meaningful difference between left and right in Israel. And when I mean left and right, I mean the so-called Zionistic left, Labor and others, and the right-wingers. The difference is only by rhetorics. So those of you, and I know some of my Israeli friends who bought already some champagne bottles, ready to open them the moment that Benjamin Netanyahu will be impeached or even go to jail, and they will celebrate how Israel is coming from darkness to light, how freedom and peace is around the corner because we got rid of the tyrant, the right-winger, the fascist, and after this, the light is around the corner. As usually, I have bad news for you. Because by the end of the day, when you judge the real policy, not the rhetorics, yes, Labor and left are having much more sympathetic rhetorics. Between other sins that I committed, one of my sins was working for Shimon Peres for 4 years. He didn't stop talking about putting an end to the occupation. He didn't stop talking about it's not democratic and not justice that one people governs another people. Beautiful, beautiful ideas that Benjamin Netanyahu and those right-wingers would have never say. But by the end of the day, Peace Nobel Prize winner Shimon Peres is the founding father of the settlements project. So what do we get out of this nice rhetorics except of showing a nice face of Israel and doing the very, very, very same crimes? So I'm here not to spread optimism, as you might know me by now. But when it comes to the basic, Israel is really united. I still remember, Grant, those days in which the joke was that the two Israelis share three views. Today, three Israelis share hardly one view. And it will be not only Zionist, but pro-occupation. As you might know, occupation is off the table in Israel. Nobody talks about it. Nobody discussed it. Nobody is concerned about the occupation. It is, you know, like one of those things, like the rain, like the sun, force majeure. Some like it less. But nobody thinks that anything can be done about it. It doesn't bother us so much. That's the truth. It's only half an hour away from our homes, but who hears about it and who cares about it? And the crimes are on a daily basis, but really daily basis. The media hardly covers them, and if they cover them, it will be always according to the Zionistic narrative. A terrorist of 12, a girl of 14 with scissors in her hands as an existential threat to the state of Israel. A girl who is slapping a soldier as someone who deserves life sentence, not less than this. A girl that 1 hour before her cousin was shot in his head, 50 meters away from her home. So now the Israeli army claims that this was fabricated. I mean, even the Israeli propaganda lost its shame. When Israel dares to claim that this child, Muhammad Tamimi, whom I met a few days after he was injured, he lost half of his brain, that he fabricated his injury, then you see that Israel is really desperate. If Israel needs this kind of level of propaganda, if Israel is getting so low in denying shooting in the head of a child of 15 and claiming that he fell from the bicycles, then you know that things are getting worse. Maybe it's a hope for a new beginning. But right now, look how low does it get there. And all those are passing Israeli society as if nothing is happening. No question marks, very little moral doubts, if at all. A cover-up, living in denial like never before. I cannot think about one society which lives in such denial like the Israeli society. And again, it includes left and right, except of the very devoted extreme left activists. Let's remember them. But they are really small in figures and totally, totally delegitimized. So when I speak about left, I mean Labor, Yesh Atid, the new promise of Israeli politics, and maybe the next prime minister, Yair Lapid, and all the rest. In many ways, they are worse than the right-wingers because they feel so good about themselves, because they are so sure that they are so human and universal and moral, while the right-wingers at least don't cover up. They say, yes, we are fascists. So what's wrong about it? We are Jews and we have the right to be fascists. Because we are the chosen people, we have the right and nobody is going to tell us what to do. When it comes to the central left, as it's called, I can hardly pronounce it, central left, what do those people have to do with left? But when it comes to the central left, it's a rare combination in which you feel so good about yourself. You are not one of those fascists. You are not one of those nationalist racists. You are a liberal. But the occupation must go on. And the child must, Hayat Tamimi, must stay in jail forever. And the crimes must continue because we have no other choice. Which brings me to the set of values which I see as the core of Israeli society nowadays. Three or four sets of values which explain everything, in my view. The first very deep-rooted value, and let's face it, is the value that we are the chosen people. Seculars and religious will claim so. And even if they don't admit it, they feel so. And the implementation is very simple. If we are the chosen people, who are you to tell us what to do? Who are you? Who is the international community to tell Israel what to do? International law, wonderful thing. It doesn't apply on us. It applies on any other place on earth, not on Israel. Because we are the chosen people, don't you understand it? Asylum seekers, 88% of the Eritreans are recognized as refugees in Europe. You know how many of them in Israel? Less than 1%. Less than 1%. Why so? Because we are a special case. You don't expect us to absorb 40,000 asylum seekers. How can you expect us? We can't. We can't. And we are the chosen people. And we don't need to prove it. The second very deep-rooted value is obviously the value of we, the victims, not only the biggest victims, but the only victims around. I know many occupations which were longer than Israeli occupation, than the Israeli occupation. Some were even more brutal, even though it's getting harder and harder to be more brutal than the Israeli occupation. I don't recall one occupation in which the occupier presents himself as the victim. Not only the victim, the only victim. If to quote here the late Golda Meir, whom I quoted also last time, I know, but it is so unforgettable, I have to use it again. She once said that we will never forgive the Arabs for forcing us to kill their children. We are the victims. We are forced to kill their children. Poor us. And as the victim and the only victim in history, again, it enables us the rights to do whatever we want, and nobody is going to tell us what to do because we are the only victims. To this, there is a third, very deep-rooted value. And this is the very deep belief, again, everyone will deny it, but if you scratch under the skin of almost every Israeli, you'll find it there. The Palestinians are not equal human beings like us. They are not like us. They don't love their children like us. They don't love life like us. They were born to kill. They are cruel. They are sadists. They have no values, no manners. Look how they kill us. This is very, very deep-rooted in Israeli society, and maybe that's the key issue. Because as long as this continues, nothing will move. As long as most of the Israelis don't perceive the Palestinians as equal human beings, we are so much better than them. We are so much developed than them. And we are so much human than them. As long as this is the case, all our dreams, and we have some dreams, and I'll get to them, all our dreams will never become true as long as this core issue will not change. So you have a society with a deep conviction in its justice, in its right way, with very, very few question marks. Anyone who dares to raise a question mark is immediately, in a very systematic way, is immediately erased, demolished. It's unbelievable how this machinery works in Israel. We are talking here about how efficient is the Jewish lobby here. Look at the Jewish lobby, so-called, in Israel, breaking the silence. For years, we were dreaming about the day that soldiers will stand up and say the truth. Not Gideon Levy, the liar, the traitor, who tells us all kinds of stories about the Israeli crimes. No, soldiers who have committed those crimes will just come and testify about what they have been doing. And here it came. Over 1,000 testimonies of soldiers who, in a very brave way, gave their testimonies about what they have been doing in the occupied territories throughout the years. This should have been an earthquake in any healthy society. It's our sons. But what happened? Nothing. Breaking the silence was immediately delegitimized by the establishment with the typical collaboration with the Israeli media. And I'm afraid to say that breaking the silence is crashed today. And this is just one example. Israeli society, especially in the last years, has a very clear intention to crash any kind of criticism from within and from outside. And this is going through legislation, through campaigns, through the media, and it's just in its beginning. In this way, I must say, there might be a slight difference between so-called left and right in Israel, because the Israeli left has some kind of commitment, at least for the democracy for the Jews. Because as you might know, Israel is maybe the only place on earth with three regimes. We are having three regimes. One is a so-called liberal democracy for its Jewish citizens, which have many cracks now, but it is still functioning. I have total freedom in Israel. This must be mentioned here. I write whatever I want. I appear on TV. I can't claim that someone is shutting my mouth, except of people in the street who wouldn't like to see me or spitting at me or who are threatening me. But by the end of the day, this freedom, which I don't take for granted and might not last for long, but this freedom is there. So that's the first regime in the front. Then comes the second regime, a very discriminative regime toward the Israeli Palestinians, the Palestinians of 48, the Israeli citizens who are Palestinians, 20% of the population. They are discriminated in any possible aspect of life, but they gain formal equal civil rights. They vote, they elect, they can be voted, they can be elected. And that's the second regime. And obviously the third regime, which Israel is hiding, is the military occupation, is the military regime in the occupied territories. And here I allow myself to say with no doubt that this is today one of the most brutal, cruel tyrannies on earth. Not less than this. I repeat it, the military occupation in the occupied territories is today one of the brutal, cruel tyrannies on earth. How dare can someone call Israel the only democracy in the Middle East when in its backyard there is one of the most cruel, brutal tyrannies in the world? How can you do it? Can you be half pregnant? Can you be half democratic? Can you be a democracy in the front and a tyranny in your backyard? And here comes the next lie that we should fight. The claim that it is all temporary. No, my friends, it was never meant to be temporary. It is not temporary, and it will not be temporary if it depends on Israel. There was never an Israeli statesman in an important position, an influential position, prime minister or so, who really meant to put an end to the occupation. None of them. Some of them wanted to gain time in order to strengthen the occupation. Some others wanted to gain time by getting all kind of interim agreements just for gaining time. Some others wanted to be perceived by the world, to be hugged by the world as people of peace. But none of them had the intention to put an end to the occupation. And how do I know it? I don't know what is in their hearts. I know only one thing. Israel had never stopped building settlements. And anyone who builds one house in the occupied territories have no intention whatsoever to put an end to the occupation. And those bluffs should be called. And here I come to you all. As I'm very, very skeptical about change from within the Israeli society, because life in Israel is far too good and brainwash system is far too efficient, to have a dialogue today with most of the Israelis is even for me almost an impossible job. Really, it's in many times I find myself together with Katrin when we meet ordinary Israelis, good people. They would volunteer anywhere. But when you start to talk with them about the occupation, after 2 minutes you want just to tear your hairs. I mean, you don't know what to do. You don't know where to start. Brainwash is so deep, and the denial is so deep, and the ignorance, they know nothing. Anyone in this hall knows so much more about the occupation than any average Israeli, including those who served there in the army. They know nothing, and what they know is wrong. So to expect a change from within this society, when restaurants are packed, when life is beautiful, when there is hardly terror in Israel, there's hardly, I mean, even what they call terror, those exploding buses and all those things, the only violent attacks are mainly now in the occupied territories, not in Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is living a very, very peaceful, secure life. So to expect this society to stand up and to say no more, out of what? What incentive? So as long as this balance is that Israel is either gaining out of the occupation or not paying anything for it, as long as any Israeli doesn't feel that the occupation is something he should think about, why should he be bothered? He doesn't pay, he's not punished, and even if he's paid, he does not make the linkage. Because even if there were those years of the Second Intifada, which were really, really bloody, with exploding buses and suicide bombers, nobody made the linkage to the occupation. If you dare to make the linkage, you will be immediately accused as a traitor, because how dare you, because you justify terror. So they explode buses because they were born to kill. It has nothing to do with the occupation. So there was no progress or change, even not after the violence. So if life is so good, there is really no reason to go for a change, and therefore the hopes for change from within the Israeli society are really, really very minimal. And again, with all the respect to those groups who are fighting, who are not giving up, who are struggling, who are going to demonstrate every Friday in another village against the fence, against the occupation, against all those things, wonderful people, including many, many young people. But finally, it is a small group and delegitimized. And therefore, people like me, my only hope is from people like you. That's right now the only hope. And we are hearing here today, all day, including from Grant's very, very knowledgeable lecture, figures that are depressing even me. The Jewish lobby is so strong yet. But by the end of the day, let's see it in a more realistic way. They are moving now the American embassy to Jerusalem. Big victory for Israel. Big victory for the occupation. By the end of the day, what does it mean? It means that the United States has declared officially the death of the two-state solution. It means that the United States had declared officially what we knew for many, many years, that the United States is not and cannot be a fair mediator. It declared that the United States is officially the friend of the occupation and only of the occupation. It declared officially that the funeral of the two-state solution and the funeral of America as a mediator in the Middle East went to its way already. For the long run, I see it as an achievement. End of the masquerade. End of the masquerade, end of the lip services. And I'm very grateful, you'll be surprised, to Donald Trump who brought us there. Now, I just feel sorry for one person, but you know, this is not so much. I really feel so much sympathy, empathy, and sorrow for Ambassador David Friedman. He will have to move from Herzliya by the sea, from this lovely villa, to Jerusalem, and believe me, he deserves it. The ambassador of the settlements with the costume of the American ambassador is even not the ambassador of Israel. He's ambassador of the settlements project and not of all settlements, just the extreme ones, if there is a difference, will have to move to Jerusalem. What is a bigger gift for all of us than to see him among the Orthodox, among the tensions, among the border police every corner, with all the violence and the tension and the occupation in every step you step in Jerusalem? What will be more of a gift for us than to see him there rather than to see him in front of the Sea of Herzliya? So we shouldn't give up. And if I may, with all my modesty, my ideas for what you should do, who am I to tell you? I hardly know what to tell myself what to do. But still, I saw it in three main issues right now. One must be to fight this unbelievable process of criminalization of criticizing Israel. This must stop, and we shouldn't give up. We heard today that it's not only about BDS anymore. Now it's about any critic about Israel. The fact that someone who raises his voice for justice is criminalized is, first of all, a domestic problem. What kind of society is this? What kind of society is this that criminalizes those who support justice and praises those who support the violations of international law, the crimes? So this should be one of our goals, not to give up. And when they call you anti-Semites, here it's Israel. In Europe, they get paralyzed. If you call someone an anti-Semite in Europe, he's paralyzed. And they take advantage of it in a very manipulative way. Don't let them. You should be proud in raising your voice. BDS right now is the only game in town. BDS is a legitimate tool. Israel is using it by calling the world to boycott Hamas, to boycott Iran. You have the full right not to buy products from sweatshops in South America, South Asia. You have the full right not to buy products from a shop which sells meat. And you have the full right not to buy products from a country or from an area that you feel that something is wrong there. What does it mean that you should apologize for boycotting something that deserves boycott? And BDS, one can claim that had not yet reported about real success, economical successes maybe, but we have one proof why BDS is the right thing to do. Look how Israel gets nervous about BDS. And if they get so nervous about it, you can know that's the right way. Grant, if you'll invite me next year again or in 2 years, I'm not sure I will be able to say those sentences because those sentences very soon will become a violation of the Israeli law. You are not allowed to call people to boycott Israel, but let's challenge them. The second challenge that I see for you is to try to tear, especially in this country, the lie that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. We need it desperately. It's all about the truth. It's all about telling the people the truth. And as I said before, a state which possesses one of the most brutal tyrannies on earth cannot be called a democracy, period. And the last lie that you have to fight, or I allow myself to suggest you to fight, is the lie that all this is temporary. After 50 years of occupation, why would we say after 50 years? After 100 years of occupation, or after 70 years of occupation? Because 48 never stopped. Let's remember it. It's the same policy. Those are the same methods, same lies, same brainwash, same explanations and excuses. And as long as this continues, nobody can claim that this is temporary. The occupation is there to stay, and we should call the bluff and say, this colonialistic project has no intention to come to its end, even though here and there are some statesmen or politicians who claim so. No, you never had an intention to put an end to it, and you don't have it. And as it says 000 in my timer, is it an appreciation for my talk, Grant? 3 zeros? In any case, my last sentence would be, what should be the solution? And it was mentioned here, and therefore I'm not getting into elaborating on it, but I just feel committed to say so. For many years, I was a great supporter of the two-state solution. I saw that the two-state solution is a reasonable and achievable solution. Total justice will never be achieved in this part of the world. But I thought that this will be a relatively fair, just solution, even though a lot of injustice is about it. Above all, we are dealing about 22% to the Palestinians and 78% to the Jews. While we are facing today, I don't know how many of you are familiar to the very dramatic fact that today, already today, between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, there are exactly 50-50, 6 million Palestinians and 6 million Jews. If you count 2.5 million in the West Bank, 2 in Gaza and 2 in Israel, you get over 6 million Palestinians, and there are 6 million Jews, roughly speaking. Maybe I'm wrong in some figures, but it is roughly half enough, two peoples equal right now. So if someone thinks that one people can dominate another people, and let's get back to Zionism and to the title of this talk, the basic of Zionism is that there is one people which is privileged over the other. That's the core. And this cannot go on. And if it goes on, it has only one name. In Hebrew, we call it apartheid. So I totally join your analysis today, which I learned a lot of, and others. Even if it sounds now like a utopia, even if it sounds now like something unthinkable, it's time for us to change the discourse. It's time for us to talk about equal rights, about one person, one vote. And let's challenge Israel. Israel will say no. Then we can officially declare Israel as an apartheid state. Because there is no other way. If you deny equal rights, you are not a democracy officially. It's not a question of point of view, of opinion. It's a matter of fact. And Israel obviously will say no. But we shouldn't give up, because by the end of the day, I truly believe that Palestinians and Israelis, Palestinian Jews, can live together. We tried it in the past. It is being tried today in all kinds of small frameworks. We can really live together. Believe me, I'd rather have a Palestinian prime minister than a Yair Lapid or Benjamin Netanyahu. So by the end of the day, we should be clear about the hope, about the vision. We should understand that the road is still very, very long to go. We are just in the beginning. But unlikely, at least for me, unlikely the last years in which I continue to say almost out of my sleep, two-state solution, knowing that it will never happen, knowing that no one is going to evacuate 700,000 settlers, knowing that nobody meant to do it, and knowing that it will not solve the basic problem. So we have a vision. We have, meanwhile, some goals. There is so much work to do for you and for us. So let's not waste more time on talkings. Thank you very much.
We've got time for just a couple of questions. And he managed to outpace a lot of these questions, so it's rather easy. And I'll let him take a sip of water first. But one of the questions is, could the occupation continue to exist without United States support, comma, please elaborate?
Could the occupation continue? Yes. Could it continue without the United States, even not for a few months? And this must be clear. If it would have been an American president who would really like to put an end to the occupation would have ended a long time ago. There was never an American president who wanted so. I stand here so I see everyone.
Sure.
Yeah. Thank you. Because then you don't know who is talking.
Don't know. The other question is extremely interesting. An esteemed scholar made this argument to me last night. I'm not going to say who it was, but his first name starts with an N and his second name starts with an F. And so anyway, this is his argument. It says, what do you say to those who say that BDS furthers Israeli narratives about being victims and needing security?
It is a very good question, and we know from the past that many times pressure from the outside united Israel, but only for the first time, for the first while, for the first period of time. By the end of the day, we have to confront the Israelis with their reality, because they are totally disconnected from reality. And I want to see the Tel Avivian, who will realize that if he wants to go to Europe, he needs a visa. That he wants to export some of his goods, He's going to work very hard to do so, if at all. And then he will ask himself, does it worth it? Does it really worth it? And I can assure you that after the first rhetorics of we are all united against the whole world, which is always against us and they all hate us, then rationality will come into the picture. I once thought that Austrian Airlines can bring peace. How can this be? Because in the last attack of Israel on Gaza in 2014, some airlines stopped flying to Israel, and it happened to be that Austrian was the first one. I think it lasted like 20 hours. But in those 20 hours, Israel went mad. I mean, Israelis lost their temper. It was crazy. And then I thought, imagine yourself that Austrian Airlines, that's just a daydream, Austrian Airlines declares that as long as the occupation continues, Austrian Airlines is not flying to Israel. The occupation comes to its end without days. When Israelis will be prevented to get to Macy's for their shoppings, or to get to Galerie Lafayette in Paris for the shoppings, this will be the day that the occupation will be over.
Thank you. So this question says, it seems many Israelis who become fully disillusioned simply leave Israel. Is there any hope of Israel changing from within when you have so many people with somewhat similar views to yours leaving?
Unfortunately, we can't count on this. Yes, there are good Israelis who cannot take it anymore, and some of them are leaving. I hear more and more Israeli parents, which I never heard before, who wish that their children will not stay there. This I never heard before, because for parents it was always a catastrophe if some of their children would leave. You hear it more and more, obviously in very certain circles. But by the end of the day, when we look at the figures, those are not meaningful figures. Yes, there are some good ones who leave. Yes, many more are talking about it. But by the end of the day, this will not be a game changer, not for the time being.
Okay, last question then. It says, you have many readers in Israel and abroad, and you can say so many things that journalists in the U.S. can't seem to find a way to do. Why is it that you get to be Gideon Levy and nobody else does?
As if it is such a great fun to be Gideon Levy. I wish I wasn't. I wish I was a restaurant critic, going from one restaurant to the other and write my truth about the food that I had. And nobody would have raised this question. I really, it's not for me to answer. I really, as I said here last time, and I always say, I was really a good boy, Tel Aviv. I was really raised up to be something else, and something went wrong. But now it's too late to correct it. I'm trying, but I really don't have any other choice but to continue. Many times people say, keep up your good work and so forth. I don't have really any other choice. It's even not a question of choice. I'm doomed to it, yeah. But seriously speaking, the fact that I can still raise my voice, as I said before, should not be taken for granted. If this regime, this government, or a very similar government will continue with the same way, they will get to us as well. Haaretz is an island in Israel. Don't get wrong. Haaretz is not Israel. Haaretz is really an island in a very, very stormy ocean. And they'll do anything possible to close Haaretz down. And the fact that I have such a wonderful home with such a... Really, I don't think there is one publisher in the world, when he gets a protest of a reader or of a subscriber who is very angry at me, you know what he tells them? He tells them, you know, Haaretz is not a newspaper for you. Don't read it. A publisher who is really struggling on the existence of Haaretz. We are really struggling on each reader and each subscriber. And he say, you know, it's not for you. It's not for you. So these are really very little hopes. But maybe it's good to conclude this afternoon with some kind of hope and optimism. As long as Haaretz is there, I will be there hopefully. As long as this voice is still being raised, maybe there is a hope. I don't know. But thank you so much again for coming today. Thank you.
That was Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist who writes a regular column published in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. And by the way, when we hear Israelis complaining that Hamas wants to drive all the Jews out of Palestine, there's an implied presumption that the first Israeli settlers came in peace, expecting to live alongside the Arabs sharing the land. The pronouncements of Israel's founders and subsequent prime ministers and other officers contradict that assumption, but it's often overlooked in the Western media as we're presented with a narrative depicting the Israelis as the humane and responsible parties and the Palestinians as the irrational and violent ones. Here, however, is a clip of our own former President Harry Truman talking about the foundation of Israel and how he perceived it.
But don't think that decision to recognize Israel is an easy one. I had to make a compromise with the Arabs and divide Palestine. The Jews wanted to chase all the Arabs into the Tigris and Euphrates River, and the Arabs wanted to chase all the Jews into the Red Sea. And what I was trying to do was to find a homeland for the Jews and still be just with the Arabs. But when you go into a thing of that kind, the people you help most are the ones that get most angry with you. Both of them were against me on the situation, but as President of the United States, I paid no attention to them, carried out what I thought was right, and I had the support of the Congress, and I could do it, which is unusual in these days.
Could you tell us specifically that a lot of Jewish people were against you, too?
There were a lot of Jewish people against me because they wanted the whole of Palestine. As I say, they wanted to drive all the Arabs into the Tigris and Euphrates rivers.
That was Harry Truman talking about the foundation of Israel. Note, by the way, that he talks about the Jews in Israel, at least a good portion of them, wanting to push the Arabs all the way to the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Might be an interesting idea to look up those rivers and see just where they are. They're not really anywhere close to the current borders of Israel. Just some food for thought here on Conscious Voices, which can be heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 91.9 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
When the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.